Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Audio Road. Welcome to Trends in Technology. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. Lisa Campbell is your producer and call screener extraordinaire. If you want to join in, simply press 1 on your phone, and Lisa will be right with you. This is the show where we explore what's going on in the trucking industry. It's a mix of new products, new services, and new technology. We'll also bring you expert guests from all areas of the industry, such as Bruce Melanson on diesel engines and performance, and Mike Beckett on tires and alignment, as well as many others. Sit back, relax, and listen, or jump in with your question or comment. It's up to you. This is your show. Once again, welcome to Trends in Technology. And here we go. Let's head on down the audio road.
Hi, this is Lisa. Remember to talk to Kevin. Press 1 so I can pick up the phone and screen your calls. You know you'd rather talk to me anyways. Or just sit back, relax, and listen to the show. And at any time you have a question, just hit 1 and I'll pick up the phone.
Welcome, everyone, to Trends in Technology. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. We'll be here for the next hour taking your calls and answering your questions. If you're listening online and you want to join us on the call itself, you can do that by dialing 347-884-8327. If you're on the call, you can press 1 at any time. If you've got a question, a comment, a topic, whatever it might be, press 1. Lisa will screen your calls. We'll get to those here shortly. The number again to join us, there are still some lines open, 347-884-8327. Joining me tonight for the entire hour will be Bruce Melanson from Pittsburgh Power. Bruce and I will be talking about what's going on and answering your questions. Before I do that, though, I want to get to a CARB update. And I'm going to read the two press releases that were put out by CARB this week. They had another board meeting. I just want you to pay attention. I'm going to read them. You see if you can follow along and if you have any idea what CARB is actually doing with any of their regulations. Here we go. The first one is about the truck rule. The second one is about the reefer rules. But I'm just going to read these. You tell me what you think. All right, here's the headline. CARB again says it may delay multi-billion dollar on-road truck rule. Some truck owners may benefit from the California Air Resources Board's repeated hints that it could relax its on-road truck and bus regulation. A weakened U.S. economy and corresponding drops in truck emissions in recent years appears to have convinced the nation's most aggressive air quality agency to consider a delay in enforcement of the rule for 2 years. Written under the authority AB 32, the 2006 law that addresses global warming, the truck and bus rule is also known as the retrofit rule. It requires trucking fleets to acquire diesel particulate matter filters and upgrade their truck engines beginning in 2012. CARB first announced in March it would consider slowing enforcement of the on-road rule, a sentiment the Air Quality Agency repeated during its board meeting this week. It's unclear whether small trucking businesses, which already were exempt from enforcement of the rule until 2014, will be affected by the potential delay. Small trucking fleets are defined as in the on-road rule as fleets of 1 to 3 trucks. CARB's estimates have placed the rule's cost impact at between $6 and $10 billion. The truck and bus regulation was tarnished last December when it was revealed that CARB Chairman Mary Nichols knew the truck regulation's top researcher falsified his resume and lied repeatedly to his superiors at the Air Quality Agency. CARB board member John Tellis criticized both Nichols and Tran, the CARB statistician who later admitted he lied. Nichols admitted that she told a few members of the board but didn't share it with the entire board before the rule was adopted in 2008. The board decided in 2009 to reevaluate the science behind the rule this spring. The report was written, over 50% of it, by an author who has misrepresented his education. To me, that means the report is not acceptable. In March, CARB also announced it would delay the second phase of its two-tiered TRU. TRU is Transport Refrigeration Unit. You could call it the reefer rule. So this is the big announcement that we were waiting until April for. And what did they announce? I still don't understand when anybody is going to have to comply with this rule. Is it 2012? Is it 2014? Big carriers, small carriers, and you know, they call a fleet of four trucks, they consider them a big carrier. In order to be a small fleet, you have to be 1 to 3. So if I have four, now all of a sudden I'm a big carrier. So that's the truck rule. I've been waiting. They said they were going to announce new dates in April, but it seems to me like they announced nothing. Now, you want to talk about confusing. Let me read the reefer rules and what's happened with those. See if you can figure these out. Here's the headline. One TRU over the line. CARB staff proposes reefer rule change. Remember, TRU stands for reefer, Transport Refrigeration Unit. The California Air Resources Board may soon be changing its regulations for trucks that haul reefers. On Wednesday, CARB staff presented several changes to its Transportation Refrigeration Unit rule, a two-step regulation for reefers. Under the proposed changes, model year 2001 and older reefers would be required to meet the ultra-low emission standards by December 31st of 2017. Currently, the rule schedule require those reefers to meet the ultra-low standard by 2015. Model year 2002 reefers would have the ultra-low standard enforced 2 years later than the current timetable of 2016 to the year 2018. 2003 reefers would be required to meet the low emission standard by December 31st of 2010 and required to meet the ultra low standard by 2019. Current schedule requires 03 model reefers to meet the ultra low standards by December 2010. I'm going to jump in here and edit now as reading. Is anybody nearly as confused as I am? Back to the article. CARB announced that since it began enforcing the first requirements of the TR rule in January and February, 2,800 inspections resulted in 55 citations for failure to register and 157 citations for not meeting the state's TRU emission requirements, and $180,000 in penalties assessed. CARB says its TRU inspection teams enforce the regulation at distribution centers, scales, border crossings, truck stops, ports, intermodal facilities, and other locations. I'm not going to read any more of the article because it doesn't say much, but you know, I sat down one whole day and I thought I had a handle on all the dates and the low emissions and ultra low emission standards. And now they put out these press releases. And from what I can tell, all the press releases says they're considering changes again. Well, they told us 4 months ago they were considering the changes and said they would tell us in April. I am just amazed at how much California is costing the industry, not only with their regulations, but in their inability to decide on what the regulations really are. If you've got any questions about that, jump in. I'm going to get to Bruce Mallinson from Pittsburgh Power, and let me find him here. Got a lot of calls on the line. There he is. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. How are you?
I'm doing great. Can you believe all that garbage?
It's incredible. Totally incredible. Sometimes I think back of, you know, life in the 50s and the 60s and how easy things were and how people were about progressing and developing things, and companies wanted to make things better, and products were made in the U.S. And now it's just it's horrible. It's horrible what's happened to our country, how we've given it away, how labor unions killed it in the 60s and the 70s, and now corporate leaders with all their greed and their stock market greed, and it's incredible.
And the government. Don't forget the government. Federal, and we can just look at California. It's kind of like a vision of the future if we keep going the way we are, because the federal government has given the EPA all kinds of new authority. Nobody's really talking about that, but the EPA is now an enforcement agency, not just a regulatory agency. And that just happened recently, and we can expect the EPA to start doing things the way CARB is doing things, and it's just crazy.
You know, the other day we got in six connecting rods and went to balance them, and two, three different countries each made two of the rods.
You're kidding.
No. And the weights were so far out that we couldn't even balance them. We had to get six more.
Wow.
That's just horrible.
It is. What engine?
I don't want to say. I don't want to intimidate any of the companies. We're finding this issue with all three that we do right now.
Is it really?
Coming to Gatton, Detroit. Yeah. Yeah. And back in the days of the big cams, they had a lot of meat. They had a boss on the top and a boss on the bottom, and that's where you could take your weight from. They've eliminated that, so now the rods have to be relatively close because you just have to polish metal off.
Just not even enough there to take something off to get them to balance, huh?
That is correct. That is correct. A couple things I wanted to say.
Sure.
I still have people calling me every day, and they can't tell me which engine they have.
Wait,
and they
what
own,
do you mean?
They drive this engine every day, and they live with this engine. Oh, I have a C15 cat. Well, happens to be six or seven different C15 cats. You know, is it an A-cert? Is it a Bridge? Is it a 2WS? You know, it's just, and people don't seem to know if they have a D-Deck 3, 4, or 5. And you need to look on your valve cover or wherever your data tag is and see which engine you have. It makes it much easier. Or people will call up and start telling you about their problem. They didn't tell you what kind of truck they have or which engine they have.
Well, you know, you talked about how things used to be so simple. Remember how easy it used to be to know what engine you had? I mean, it is more complicated now. We should know it, but it's not as simple as it used to be.
Right. I mean, it's just, if you've got a 6NZ or if you got a 1LW or if you got an MXS cat or a D-Deck 4, or if you have an N14 or an ISX, you should know your CPL. It's right on the tag, right on the engine. And you need to know this whenever you're calling about questions. Some of the questions now are, one of the things I'm researching is, can we take a C13 cat and convert it back to a C12? Well, there's a tremendous amount of parts that have to be changed. And whenever you tell somebody, we don't even know if this can be done yet or what the price is. And then you get calls, well, I have an A-cert cat and I want to make it back to a single turbo. That's about a $12,000 deal. Well, why is it so much? Well, you need to buy a manifold. You need to buy a turbo. You need to buy an ECM. You need to move cam timing sensor from the front of the engine to the back of the engine. It's a two-day job, and it's a lot of parts involved.
Yeah.
And so if you have an A-cert and the A-cert is running okay, leave it a dual turbo until it's rebuild time. And then speaking of the CARB, I did have a phone meeting with the president of Fleet Guard, and they're going to be willing to work with us to build DPFs, and our Pittsburgh Power engineers will build the computer to control it, so we'll be able to retrofit DPFs, urea injection, whatever else we need on the older trucks.
That's good news.
Yeah.
That's really good news. That gives us another option. You know, when we started talking and building glider kits, and you know, now we're talking about just totally reconditioning older trucks and keeping them. The biggest question I get from people is, but I run California, what am I going to do? And we haven't had an answer for them yet. I've been telling people, look, first of all, I'm not going to run my business based on what California is doing, because look at what they keep doing. They keep changing the dates and changing the rules of the game. But it would be nice to know that when the time comes, if you have to run California, there's going to be an option for the older trucks.
Did you listen to the opening day of the Olympics?
No.
The statistics between Canada and the U.S.?
No.
There are more people living in California than the entire country of Canada.
That doesn't surprise me, I guess.
90% of the population of Canada lives within 90 miles of the U.S. border. So when we all get fed up with everything, all we have to do is move 100 miles north into Canada, and we're away from everyone.
What? Can't we just send all the people in California to Canada?
Yeah, that would probably help.
You know, if they're so concerned about clean air, if we send them far enough north in Canada, the air is really clean up there.
That's right. Hey, another thing, it's still lots of phone calls. A lot of people aren't getting fuel mileage, and every single one of them run cruise control religiously on rolling hills, mountains, all the time. And you got to drive that truck with your foot and pay attention to the boost gauge. And you have to be smooth with the pedal, this up and down, taking your boost from 5 to 30, back down to 10, up to 25. That's a killer on fuel mileage. And you'll never, I don't care what you do to your truck, you will never obtain fuel mileage if you don't have a smooth foot. And not everybody has it.
Speaking of that, I was talking about, well, I talk about it, you know, quite often on the show, try to teach people kind of the method of getting up and down those hills. And I got a call, I don't know, a week or two ago, and the guy said he was listening, and he runs from the Midwest to the West Coast and back. So you know that he's got a lot of hills in there before he gets out to the West Coast. And he said it was one of his first times listening to the show, and the only thing he changed in his operation, the only thing he changed was he turned the cruise off when he got to the hills, and he started using that method, and he said his fuel mileage is up on a 30-day average. It's up 7/10 of a mile per gallon.
7/10.
And that's all he changed.
Saying for years, it's a half a mile of the gallon. Cruise control costs you a half mile of the gallon. You can run it on the level. When you see that boost gauge going up and down, that means it's giving it fuel, taking fuel away, giving it fuel, and that is not how you drive. You got to think of that roller coaster, and you got to use momentum.
Hey, going back to one thing you said when you were talking about knowing which engine you had and looking on the tag and all the different models. I mean, that sounds like a great article. Have you written that one yet?
Oh, you know, I started writing in May of 1989, and I think I've written about it, but there's so many old articles, I think I need to bring some of them back and rewrite them because people just haven't seen them.
That would actually be a good one. If you wrote that so that, you know, you explain to somebody how to find the tag, how to read the tag, and then listed the different engines, you know, from each manufacturer and what they mean. If it's a 6NZ, here's kind of what it is. If you wrote that article, that'd be great to have it up on the website as a reference.
Well, maybe I'll do that. I'll make a note of that right now. You know how I am on my notes. I have them stuck everywhere.
Yeah. We have a picture of that somewhere, I think.
Well, my new office is starting to look like the old one now. I'm trying not to let it get that way. Oh, another thing. The other day, a guy tried to tell me that he's got a single over 13 speed with his Detroit. for 355 gears, and there is absolutely no way. I said, what do you run at 60 mile an hour? He said, 1,300. I says, you're a double over. He said, it is not. It absolutely is. And in the last article I wrote about driving your 18 and your 13 speed, dropping down two gears or running direct, and a fella called from, I think it was Minnesota, very, very sharp owner-operator, and he said that that is not true. He said, when we're in double over, we're only turning one gear up in the front of the transmission. So after the Louisville show, I went to Western Truck Parts, and we took the top cover off of an 18-speed, double over 18, and Alan Goebel and his number one transmission guy and I, we studied that for about 2 hours, and we shifted it and had it in various gears, and he is correct. He's turning a huge gear up in the front of the transmission that turns two gears that are on two counter shafts going down the right side and the left side, and then it turns the gears in the rear case. So you are turning extra gears when you're in double over eight.
And
or
what now in a double over 18 or 13, I guess it would be the same. When you drop back to direct, then what's happening inside the case?
Well, then it's going straight down through the center of the transmission. You're turning less gears. The other gears are turning, but they're not turning with power. They're not being driven. They're just floating in there.
That was the way I had it explained to me years ago, but I've had a lot of people argue with me about that one.
Right. Next time I'm at Western Truck Parts, I'm going to have them take a 10-speed direct and pull the cover off and look and see if maybe we would be better off with that. I like the fact that you can split a gear, though.
Right. I know. It would be really nice if they made even just a 13 direct would be a really nice transmission to have. And now you know that in 2010, we've got far more options in transmissions. And the option that they really have grown is the direct drive option. Almost all the auto shifts are now available in direct drive models, and they never used to be. The 12-speeds are available in direct drives. Volvo's I-shift transmissions are available in direct drives. So the manufacturers finally caught on to the fact that direct drives are more efficient. There's a market out there because people are starting to understand it, and they're offering that transmissions, a lot of them. The problem is I don't want their new trucks, you know? So.
Yeah, a guy called a couple weeks ago and new Caterpillar and a DPF, and 67 days last year in a garage.
67 days. How does somebody stay in business like that?
67 days. And now here's the amazing thing. We figured out what his gross was per day, and that cost him $30,000+. And the fuel mileage that he would have had if he would have let us build him a glider would have saved him another $30,000, so that's a $60,000 difference.
Unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, you know, it costs you $30,000 in downtime, but we can't even measure what it costs you in aggravation and stress.
That's right. That's exactly correct. By the way, Tuesday, another Peterbilt comes in. It'll be a full 100% signature series Peterbilt with a cat, lift axle, super singles, 2/6 double over 18. We start out on this Tuesday.
Are you
it
building
it? It is for a 69-year-old, 62 or 69-year-old fella that has 9 trucks, and he is fed up with the new DPF trucks, and he said he'll never have another one.
I agree. I sit here every night, and you know, my show has kind of changed somewhat over the years. I mean, it was originally just pure business numbers, you know, and then we started getting into fuel mileage, and then, you know, with fuel mileage, I started diagnosing what might be going wrong mechanically with the truck, and I would venture to say that the majority of our calls now are really, you know, mechanically related. It's kind of like car talk on, you know, NPR. I sit here and diagnose mechanical problems. But when I look at the call volume, it's about not at least 9 to 1 that the problem, the mechanical problem that somebody's calling about is going to be on a truck that's an 04 or newer. Maybe 1 out of every 10 questions on a mechanical issue or a problem is a pre-04 engine. And when those guys call, it's usually really easy to tell them what's going on and how to fix it. When, you know, and the call that kind of drives me nuts is a guy will call me and he'll say, I've had my 07 ISX or Detroit or CAT, doesn't matter, they're all the same anymore, Volvo, I've had it in to 6 shops. They've replaced the turbo 4 times. They've replaced EGR. They've replaced this, and it still doesn't fix it. Can you help me? Seven different shops have had their hands physically on the truck, and they can't fix it. What am I supposed to do?
It's exactly correct. I had a call the other day. A friend of mine keeps losing injectors on his ISX. What's wrong? I said, well, tell him to bring it to my shop. Well, he can't. He lives in the Southwest, and he doesn't go east. I said, what do you want me to tell you? And it's your friend. Tell your friend to call me.
Right. You know, I know. That reminds me of a call, and I need to look through my notes here because I was going to call you this week and ask you about this. I'm probably not going to find it because my desk is starting to look like yours. I have notes everywhere. he had a – I'm pretty sure it was
– at.
I'm going to sound like one of the people that call you and frustrate you because they don't have all the answers. But he had a CAT. They did an in-frame on it. And since the in-frame, he's been through 3 or 4 sets of injectors. And they can't figure out what's wrong. And somebody told him, they told him he was getting air into the fuel lines, and that's what was causing all the injector problems, and he wanted to know if the FAS would fix it.
And the answer to that is yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure. I thought he needed to figure out what's going on first. Can air in the fuel lines wipe out the injectors like that?
And the injection pump, or the fuel pump.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the air plays havoc in there. I had a guy, a similar story a few years back. They had put 6 sets of injectors in his CAT since Caterpillar rebuilt it, and he refused to spend the money for a FAS system. I said, well, then don't call me anymore because I'm telling you that's what will fix it.
Well, the crazy thing about this was they were trying to diagnose it. They realized it was air that was causing the problems, and they were installing clear fuel lines in each section of the system. And they found out that the air was happening after the filter. It wasn't prior to the filter. There was no air in the fuel prior to the filters. After the filters, air was showing up. They replaced the filter bases, filters, and they can't stop the air from showing up.
Well, see, when you put that clear line on, just to look at it, you can't see it. You have to shine like a halogen-type flashlight through it and look sideways through it. You have to look through, like if you're standing on the side of a vehicle with its headlights on and you're looking through the side of the headlights, you have to look through the side of the flashlight.
Okay.
Through the line to be able to see it. If you come to the Walcott show or the Dallas show and Brad from Fast Fuel System has his demo stand there, I'll show you. It's really hard to see the little fine droplets. The way we used to find it on a big cam, you know, we had on the AFC pump, we had the solenoid on top. We'd put 3-4 feet of hose coming out the side of the one port and put a drain valve, drain cock, and cup your hand over a bucket and open it. Hold the truck at about 1,000 RPM and open it. If you saw foam, you had air. But also you would let the fuel gather in the palm of your hand, and you could then see into it to see the really fine air bubbles. And then you knew you were also fighting air. You have to have young eyes to do that, too.
Yeah. I know how that goes. Hey, I just noticed we have all kinds of questions. What do you say we get to some?
Okay, I want to tell you what I did today. I got to drive a tandem dump with 30,000 pounds of gravel in the back, and it was a fleet truck, FLD-120 with a D-Deck 2 with a 10-speed with air ride. Now, on a two-lane road with 30,000 pounds above you, wow, when you'd go into those decambered turns, that was a little bit of a thrill.
I'll bet it was. A D-Deck 2, huh?
D-Deck 2. And it was an interesting ride today.
I'll bet it was.
The first time I drove never drove a triaxle loaded or a tandem, and this happened to be a tandem. Okay,
let's
go to the calls.
Let's go to Nebraska. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Good evening, fellas. Boy, I sure would love to sit around a table and just talk with you guys for hours. I've got so many questions.
Well, come to the CMC and you'll be able to do that in Kansas City.
Oh, man, I wish I could afford the time off to do it.
You can. Bring your work clothes, too, because we're going to have on-hands training. I'm the instructor.
Hey, Bruce, I'm not sure if Lisa's updated you recently. You know, we've got about 120 people coming right now.
Yeah, she told me in 70 trucks, I got to bring a lot of parts.
Yeah.
But, hey, Ryan, we're going to teach people how to work on their own trucks, installing dampers and balancers and mufflers and boost gauges and pyrometers and things like that.
That's all easy stuff. That's first-year auto shop stuff right there.
Yeah, but we have a lot of people in this industry now that's not mechanically inclined.
Oh, I know. I remember talking to a guy one time, a long time ago, who drove a truck for years. He said, I couldn't crawl under the truck and adjust the brakes if my life depended on it. I just thought, wow, that's amazing.
That's much more common nowadays, too.
I know.
We have people that don't know what an intake manifold is or where it is. So
It is really an eye-opener. It's funny you referenced my call earlier, Kevin. I was the one that gained 3/4 mile of a gallon driving the hills the right way.
That was you. Cool.
Yep, that was me. And I learned most of it from you. I also picked up some from your website, Bruce. Watching your videos you got on there, I remember one of them said, you got to drive the hills like we used to drive with the pedals so that you can accelerate if you need to, but you don't have to. That was a big effect on it.
Here where you have pedal left.
Exactly. I heard you mention a few minutes ago that you were just approved to be able to put DPFs on older motors.
We are working on that. That's one of my projects for this summer.
Okay.
So,
one of your competitors out there offers an ECM for a cat motor that essentially eliminates the intake valve actuators from the ECM so that they're no longer in use. Basically makes
talking
it a
about for an
A-cert.
A-cert.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah, whenever you un-A-cert a cat, when you reprogram the ECM or you have to build another ECM for it, the actuators are either removed or they're backed off.
Yeah. With that, would I be able, I mean, obviously you haven't gotten that far in your research yet, would you be able to keep that type of ECM in there and add a DPF so that it's quote-unquote legal, but what they can't see won't hurt them?
Yes, we will be able to, even like on our fresh air bypasses on some of these EGRs, we'll be able to put the DPFs on and the urea, whatever we need to do, and it won't be traceable back through the ECM.
Very good. Now, my second question, I heard from a pretty reputable guy to be careful. He said don't even use a bypass oil filter system because even though you're getting the samples and done and all that, that you get an acidic buildup in the oil that will actually take out bearings. Have you seen anything like that or ever heard of it, either one of you?
No. I started going to oil seminars 32 years ago, and one thing that I learned is when you go to a seminar, you always sit in the front row because you learn the most. Most of us should have known that back when we were in high school. But anyway, I was at one, and we had Harvard. They were 1 micron bypass filters. It was a filter that would fit right in a 750 lubrifier. Are you old enough to remember the 750 lubrifiers?
Unfortunately, I'm not.
Okay. Well, anyway, the 750 lubrifier was actually the house inside the filter was hickory wood chips. But the Harvard came along with this tightly wound paper, and it worked really well. And we took brand new hydraulic oil, and there was a particle counter. And we ran the oil through the particle counter, and it was up into 500 and some thousand parts per million of anything. You know, it recorded everything that was in it. And then we printer's ink in it, like when you would stencil a box. Remember how years ago they used to stencil boxes? We dumped that in there. We dumped Coca-Cola in there. We dumped all kinds of things in there. And the filter took it out.
Well, here's the other thing, Ryan. Have you ever done an oil sample? Have you ever looked at a report?
Yes. I haven't done one through the one that you use, but I sent one off to Cat here recently on my motor, and it came back pretty good.
Yeah, and here's the thing about acid. There's no question we don't want acid building up in the oil, but that's why the oil is formulated with a base number. TBN is what will tell us what's going on as far as the acidic content of the oil, or TAN, total acid number and total base number. Base is what keeps the oil from becoming acidic. And we can watch that total base number. And if it gets too low, if our base is starting to be depleted, then that would be an indication to change the oil before it becomes acidic. So we never let oil become acidic. And the other thing that we know is if our base is dropping too fast, then we need to look at why. What's going on in the engine that's causing such an acidic environment? It could be high idle time. Could be we're building up too much condensation. Could be that we're not completely combusting the fuel. And that gives us an indication that we need to look at the engine to figure out why it's not healthy. But if we have base, that means the oil is not acidic.
Okay. Well, that's very good to know. That's an investment I would love to make. I'd hate to drop $20,000 on a motor if I don't need to, you know?
You know, here's the big difference. You know, if we've got a bypass system and we're doing oil samples, now we know what's going on in that oil. Take the people who aren't running the bypass filter, and they're not sampling because why bother? I'm changing my oil every 15,000 miles. They've got a higher likelihood of having an acidic condition going on than somebody who's sampling all the time.
Yeah. I try to run them every oil change. Unfortunately, I got one today in a shop. They didn't have any bottles for me to take any with me, or they didn't have a sample system. I was really disappointed with that, so I guess we'll have to hit it up
on
the next
one. Hey, Ryan, here's something to think about.
Okay.
The naked eye can see 40 micron dirt. The standard filter, full flow filter on your engine is 40 micron.
Yeah.
The clearance in a rod and a main bearing is between 1 and 3 micron when you're pulling a hill. So why do you want to have the dirt that's bigger than 2 and 3 micron floating in your oil when that's your bearing film is?
The argument that, you know, we've heard for years about any kind of improvement or add-on. Well, if this was so good, the OEM would be doing it. And we know that's not true. The OEMs won't do it because of cost. But eventually, even the OEMs catch up. We've been using bypass filters for 20 years and extending drain intervals. Well, now look at the DD15 all of a sudden, 50,000-mile drain intervals. The PACCAR engine that's coming out, I haven't verified this, but I've heard 75,000-mile oil drains right from the factory. So they're finally catching on that it does make sense just to keep your oil cleaner.
Yeah. Saves a lot of money, too, that's for sure.
It does, and it is better for the engine. I mean, it's just better to keep oil clean than not keep it clean. Let's get to another call. Let's go to Iowa this time. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call, Kevin.
You're welcome.
Regarding the carb rules, has it been determined whether your operation, for the sake of argument, runs California? Are you considered three trucks, or are you considered thousands of the trucks through FedEx?
You know, I can't find that anywhere. I don't know. I've been all over the website, and they don't address when you're leased to a carrier, whether or not you have to comply based on your fleet size or your carrier's fleet size. I don't know. Wish I could tell you. I mean, I can't even figure out, you know, they said they were going to give us new dates in April, and they, you know, they write two press releases, and I still can't figure out what they've done.
I see. I got a question for Bruce.
Okay.
Charge air cooling, essentially cooling the turbo?
Cooling the compressed air out of the turbo, yes.
Okay. Would it be practical to have it water-cooled or no?
Well, water cooling is good if you could keep ice water in it. But whenever you're running the coolant through the engine, then it's that much warmer. Air coming out of a charge air cooler, they're trying to get it down to 110 degrees. The older engines that had the water jacketed after cooler, inner cooler, we usually call them after coolers, the air coming out of there was 180, 190, 200.
Okay.
Because of the water temp. Keep in mind, 20 pound of boost is 400 degrees coming out of the turbo. So air coming into the right side, this is why the door light works so well. The air coming into the right side of the charge air cooler is 400 degrees, and it's 110 coming out the left side, the driver's side. So a charge air cooler actually vibrates like a tuning fork when you're pulling a hill. And that's why it breaks at the welds. And the Duralite, being the tubes are mounted in rubber, rubber that's made in Germany, absorbs that vibration.
Hey, Bruce, is there any, you know, like when we look at radiators and, you know, some of the higher efficiency radiators, more tubes, dimpled tubes, better cooling efficiency, is there anything to that on a charge air cooler? I mean, do the Duralites cool any better?
Oh, I can't answer that. I don't know that answer.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I was just thinking about that as you were given the temperatures on either side. You know, I'm always reading stuff. You know, the internet is just amazing. I spend hours sometimes following threads around and reading different topics, and I found this fuel mileage site the other day, and it was more on autos, but then they got into diesel engines, and some of the claims that are out there are just insane. He just asked if water cooling the intake would be efficient, and you said if you could keep ice on it, and there was somebody who claimed they were using dry ice, and they were claiming on a diesel pickup that if they cooled the intake using dry ice, they were improving fuel mileage by 50%. I mean, we both know that's outrageous and insane, and it's never going to happen. But that's what they were doing. They were using dry ice to cool the intake.
Now, you see, a lot of people will call me, and they have ideas, or they think they have a gadget that's going to really set the world on fire. But it has to be practical. He then gave me something where every several hundred miles, a guy has to stop and buy a gallon of distilled water.
Yeah, right.
You know,
well,
you know, because people don't have the time to do stuff like that. So.
Well, speaking of that, I just finished another. Actually, now it's about a 40-day test on another hydrogen system. Very, very, very well made. Really nice stainless steel. It is very well made. There's no question about it. It's a $5,000 unit. And I got virtually zero fuel mileage improvement on a very controlled test. I mean, same truck, same driver, same run every day. I made the change on one truck in that run. And on the second truck that does the exact same run every day, no changes, and we tracked fuel mileage on both, so that, you know, we couldn't say, well, the weather got better or worse or anything else. We even had a control truck in the test. The control truck with no changes gained about 3 or 4 one-hundredths of a mile per gallon in a 30-day test, so it was virtually identical. The hydrogen truck gained like just slightly over 1/10 of a mile per gallon, which, I mean, we can't even really measure that much of a change. So to me, there was no change. The other problem, though, is now, you know, I posted the results and people are coming back and going, well, what was the voltage and how much water did it use and how did you activate it in the beginning and try this, turn the voltage up or do this with the chemical balance or, you know what, if the system is that complicated, then it's just not ready for the market. First of all, I don't think it works, period. But if it's going to require that much work and effort and knowledge to try to tweak this thing to get it to work, then it's just not ready for the market.
I agree. We tried it. We spent 2 years developing one, and we blew up a lot of plastic bottles.
Well, I've got a company that absolutely swears by propane, so I'm going to do a test, same thing, controlled test, and I'm going to do it based on cost, because it doesn't matter to me if propane improves my fuel mileage. If it costs me more to have propane in there, then what's the point?
Yeah, and here's the thing with propane. If you're home every week and you're in a small town where you can pull into a place that can right out and fill up your tank, that's not so bad. But if you have to go in the Flying J in the summertime and you're going to wait in line with the RVs, because remember, I spent several years on the road as a full-time RVer, and when I needed propane, I lost at least an hour every time I had to fill my propane bottles at Flying J.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to try it just to run the numbers, so I've got them, but I'm not convinced of that one either. Let's get to some more phone calls. We're running out of time. Let's go to Ohio. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin, Bruce. How you doing?
Good. What's up?
Good.
Hey, I called you 2 weeks ago. I had the oil sample had 26 on the lead, 2.1 on soot on 14,000 miles, high exhaust temperature.
Yep.
Okay. First off, I got home. I sent two samples in at the same time. The one from OPS was waiting for me. Soot on it was 1.6, and lead on it was 16.
Okay.
I took samples at the same time, and so that's how much difference the two labs were. A lot of the other items were the same or lower with the OPS. So I don't know what's going on there. But on the high exhaust temperatures, that weekend I pulled my intake off. I got a DDAC 3 Detroit that's Cummins red with no ID tag on it, so I'm kind of lost at times. But when I pulled the intake off, number one and two cylinder, the gasket was 3/4 of an inch forward of where it was supposed to be.
So your intake manifold gaskets were blown.
Yeah, I don't know if they blew or they put, you know, it looked like it was slid, but the front bolt was loose. Yeah, there was no sealing whatsoever on one and two. Also, you had the back edge of the metal in the middle of the intake. And when I took it off, when the people in Kentucky painted the motor red, they didn't cover the intake ports up. There was paint inside the intakes. When they put the intake on, they did not even clean the paint off of the mating surface. So more than likely, I was leaking around everything.
That's why when we tell people to pressurize your air intake system, we start out from the turbo and pressurize the turbo. We pressurize the tube going to the charge air cooler, the charge air cooler, the tube coming back to the intake, and the intake.
See, now, I was told
just pressurize the charge air. We pressurize everything, and that way you find those leaks.
Now, I tried that, and I couldn't get nothing, and I couldn't hear anything. But I asked the mechanic about it, and he said there's no way you can pressurize the whole system. You're going to have leakage to the valves because of valve
overlap. Yeah, but when it goes through the valves and it's sitting on top of the piston, and you will get a little bit of air leak down past the piston rings, and you'll hear that. But when you've got blown gaskets and other things, you'll hear that leak too. And also, if you have a shutoff valve on, and we'll shut it off and watch how fast it leaks. And we know, we've done it so many times, that we know how fast it's leaking past the piston rings. But when there's a crack or a blown hose or something, you can tell.
Yeah.
And some gaskets, some intake manifold gaskets have a thin piece of metal between the two pieces of paper, and when the paper blows and it just leaves the metal, it'll vibrate like a reed on a clarinet or saxophone.
Okay, these gaskets were 100% metal. There was no paper on them.
No paper.
No paper, and the ones I put back on were no paper, all metal.
But it was.
And I got them out of the. Huh?
Yeah. Well, we've seen gaskets on intake manifolds being pushed out like that.
Yeah.
Real quick,
yeah,
Bill, on the oil analysis, and I've got to move on to a couple more calls. What I'm finding, you know, years ago when I first started doing oil analysis, and I've been through a couple different filters, several different labs, occasionally I would do exactly what you would do. I would pull two samples at the same time, send them to different labs, and the results were always really close. What I've been finding lately with the OPS lab is that they've really got very sensitive equipment. They're using some of the best methods around to test, and I'm finding that I think the OPS is much more accurate, just like they were able to find the fuel in the oil when none of the other labs were able to do it because they're using a different method, and the old methods of testing for fuel won't identify ultra-low sulfur or biodiesel. And so I'm seeing more of a difference now in the readings, but after reading a bunch of them, I think I trust OPS's lab more than the others. I think they're using better equipment and better methods, and they're staying more up-to-date on a lot of this stuff. Got to get to some calls. Let's go to Lyle in Oklahoma. Lyle, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey there.
I have been duly chastised, so I pulled my truck over and flipped my hood out. Upon inspecting my thing, I have a C15 12.7 Cummins.
Well, what color is it?
It's red and green.
That's a good one. I'll bet you you had to really do some thinking to come up with that one.
Yeah, I did.
I am glad we've got that straight. Now we can diagnose your problem.
A C15 12.7 ISX comes.
I think your problem is you ran so low on blinker fluid that you put too much stress on the piston return spring.
Oh, shoot. Anyway, I do have a 12.7 Detroit 60 series. And
yeah,
I didn't
which
find
one?
Well, that's a good question. The CPL that you were talking about, I couldn't find on there.
CPL is on Cummins.
Oh, okay.
CPL is on a Cummins. On your Detroit, what year is it?
It says on my thing 2003, but the manufacture date was in February of 2002.
And that means you have a DDEC 4.
DDEC 4, okay. I didn't find it on there.
The way you can tell is if you look at the turbo, you'll see a wastegate. You'll see a diaphragm with a hose coming from the compressor housing over to the diaphragm on the turbine housing.
Okay. Well,
or you take your engine serial number. You take your engine serial number or the last six of your VIN, and you call, if it's a Freightliner, you call Freightliner and say, which engine do I have? Is it a DDEC 3, 4, DDEC 2? And then they can tell you from that, too.
Okay.
If you don't have the engine number, you can tell by the VIN or the engine number. Or
now, just for me, go ahead. For me, that's ignorant, what does DDEC stand for?
What's
Detroit
DDEC?
Diesel Electronic Control.
Oh, okay. Very good. And one thing you mentioned. Say that again.
I was going to say, hey, I learned something there tonight from Kevin.
Yeah, that's good. I'm learning all kinds of things tonight.
I didn't know that's what DDEC stood for.
Yeah.
I know who made the very first Detroit computer. It was the General Motors engineers.
Really?
But,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, General Motors engineers made it. But anyway, go ahead with your question.
Well, the question I had, I'm a cattle operator. I pull cattle, and I've kind of been blowing the gaskets on what everybody's doing out here because I don't run 110 mile an hour. The last 12,000 miles, I've got a 6.8 average pulling the cattle truck. But my question is, it shows on my thing that it's a 430 up to a 430 horsepower, and so I'm having trouble pulling hills, especially if I've got a 40-mile-an-hour crosswind.
Well, so you're pulling
a three-axle
or a two-axle trailer?
It's a two-axle trailer, 53-foot trailer.
Okay.
So my question is, I don't think, and I've got a, I believe it's a 4 or a 390 rear end in it with a 10-speed, and I don't know which kind. It's just got 10 gears and flip it up one, run through all the gears, flip it up, and run through the gears again. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that's a direct or an overdrive or I suppose it's just
it's
a regular
drive.
Okay.
If you had a direct drive with 390 gears, you'd be doing about 45 miles an hour.
Downhill.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, now let's specify how to...
So my question is, how do I determine whether a power box versus just getting the ECM reprogrammed would be more beneficial? I don't really think I need that much power. So how do you go about determining that?
Well, we like the firebox because you have 9 different power settings on the Detroit. And you can pick what power level you want to do, what you need to do for that day or that hill. Once we reprogram the ECM, wherever it is, but we can take it up to about 585 horsepower by doing that. And they do run good. It's half the money, but you don't have the adjustability issue then. And it's nice to be able to adjust your power. If you take that Detroit you have, you do the manifold, you do the turbo, and you do the power box, and if you still have a stock muffler, put our mufflers on, you'll be shocked at how that thing will run.
Hey, Bruce, we are down to about a minute. Why don't you give out some phone numbers, and we got to wrap this up.
724-360-4080, or it's bruce@pittsburghpower.com. If you have electronic questions, if you have a power box and you have questions, Gary has been with me for 30 years, and he is my lead guy. If you need to order parts, Sean is our parts manager. Pete is our vice president. He's been with me for 25 years. These guys all know as much as I do. So sometimes I'm not available, but one of those three guys always are.
All right, I'm going to give out the number one more time, 724-360-4080. Bruce, thanks for joining me. We'll do this again soon.
Well, thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure.
All right, good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us. See you in 30 minutes on the live show.